I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
Last week, in the 16th month of his presidency, Donald Trump announced an executive order to create something called the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative. It's essentially a low-budget version of the faith offices established by George W. Bush and Barack Obama, except without the burdens of worrying about, as one of its backers put it, quote, all these arbitrary concerns as to what's appropriate, unquote. You know, like the Constitution. We'll talk about why veterans of the Bush and Obama administrations are concerned about this faith office and how it fits into Trump's all-style and no-substance appeal to religious conservatives.
We'll also talk about the uproar, backlash, and division surrounding former Southern Baptist Convention President Paige Patterson, who also heads the denomination's largest seminary. Recent attention has focused on past comments in which Patterson reported counseling wives to stay in physically abusive marriages, objectified a teenage girl, and told female seminarians they weren't doing enough to make themselves physically attractive for potential husbands. Southern Baptist women, not generally known as rabble-rousers, have reacted in anger, with several thousand as of this recording signing an open letter to the Board of Trustees at Patterson Seminary.
And finally, Amy talks with journalist Ruth Graham about her most recent piece in Politico magazine, in which she does a deep dive into the role Christian media have played in defending Trump and disseminating positive messages about his administration to tens of millions of voters.
Our thanks, as always, to the show's monthly patrons who have signed up to support our work. If you like what we're doing at Impolite Company and think these conversations are important, you too can help us out by becoming a monthly sponsor. Click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up.
As you know, we usually start the show with 3 minutes of Nish, in which I get time to rant about whatever I want, but for no more than 3 minutes, much to my dismay. This week, however, Amy, you are super fired up about something, so I am going to offer my safe rage space to Amy. Amy, take us away. Your 3 minutes starts now.
The National Rifle Association held its annual meeting in Texas this week. And while we could have some fun with the fact that they elected Oliver North, yes, that Oliver North, as the organization's next president, I want to talk about the nonsense that is the NRA prayer breakfast. Yep, that's right, prayer breakfast. Now, the tradition isn't as old as the organization itself. This year was just the 20th annual prayer breakfast, which sounds about right because a few decades ago is about when some religious conservatives lost their ever-loving minds and decided that it was their Christian responsibility to support the unlimited proliferation of firearms. This year's prayer breakfast opened with an invocation delivered by one of the NRA's million-dollar donors. And it tells you everything you need to know about a theology that has made an idol of guns while forgetting the biblical admonition to fear not. The prayer seemed to start off on the right foot. Lord, we put our faith and trust in you, and not in governments or militaries or our own technology, or even the strength of our own arms. And that's where it needed to stop, because the very next word was, still. So yeah, the NRA's opening prayer was basically, Lord, we put our trust in you, but, as in, Lord, we mostly trust you to protect us, but we need you to empower us to protect ourselves. Or, you're great in everything, Lord, but we're still going to need our guns. The breakfast also featured Adam LaRouche, previously only known to me as the former White Sox first baseman. LaRouche turns out to be evangelical, and he shared his testimony with the breakfast crowd. He also proudly wore a shirt that said, Jesus loves me and my guns, and he insisted that while Jesus did spend some time talking about things like grace and mercy, he wasn't a pacifist, because he also said, I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. So okay, Adam, I'm going to need to fact check you on that. Let's start with the shirt. Jesus does love you. You're right about that. He loves all of God's children. But I am pretty pretty sure he does not love your guns. And that verse that you quoted, Jesus was referring to dividing people, not killing them. It's similar to when he tells the disciples they're going to have to leave their families and possessions behind in order to follow him. The sword is a metaphor. It's dividing people from the particulars of their past. Besides, if you want to start quoting scripture in support of your stand, you're going to have to deal with the Garden of Gethsemane. Remember when Peter drew his sword, his real sword, not a metaphorical one, to defend Jesus? You might say Peter was standing his ground. Do you remember what Jesus said? I'll help you out with that. Jesus was not having it. He rebuked Peter and told him to put that thing away. And Jesus did not mince words. All who take the sword, he said, will die by the sword. Now, I don't expect the NRA to spend part of its annual meeting listening to biblical lessons about peace and love, or debating the morality of accepting dead children as just the price that has to be paid for unfettered freedoms. But if they're going to get together to celebrate the latest in high-capacity, high-velocity weaponry, I do wish they'd leave Jesus out of it.
Let's dive in, shall we? Okay, first up, Trump's new faith-based office. Last Thursday, on the National Day of Prayer, Donald Trump announced an executive order to create the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative. If you're thinking this sounds familiar, you would be right. Both presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, had faith-based offices, both in the White House and across federal agencies. They provided support for religious organizations and other smaller nonprofits to compete for government grants, and they also occasionally advised the White House on matters of religious freedom and some other issues. Despite the concerns of many liberals during the Bush administration, the faith-based office didn't lead to a theocratic government. And President Obama actually expanded the footprint of the office and tightened some of the religious protections. But now we have the Trump version. And while we don't have a lot of information about how it was pulled together, we do know that it revokes some previous protections for the recipients of faith-based services. Essentially, it allows faith-based organizations to apply for public funding even when they don't have the intention of serving everyone in the public. Surprise, surprise. I can't help but wonder how much of his quote-unquote evangelical advisory council, you know, kind of the court evangelicals that he surrounded himself with, had a say in how much this was formed. It's really problematic.
So the interesting thing about this faith office, as announced by Trump recently, is how little thinking appears to have gone into it. Not that that's necessarily a surprise for this administration, but it really is. It's hard to overstate what a shift that is from both the George W. Bush White Houses and the Obama White House. The people who are around Trump, the ones who have been his strongest religious supporters, have not been involved with faith-based policy in the past. I mean, never mind the Obama administration. These were not the folks who were active during George W. Bush's administration when he talked about his faith-based initiative, which, don't forget, was a really important part of his domestic agenda. It was something he talked about all the time on the campaign trail in 2000, and it was something he announced or created by executive order his very first week in office in 2001. I think that a lot of liberals worried at first, because what they saw was, here's this dude from Texas who talks about Jesus a lot, and we think maybe he's just going to use this as a slush fund to reward his religious supporters. And that's really not what happened. You know, to be clear, that may have been what his political folks like Karl Rove were hoping would happen, or the message that they wanted their supporters to get, even if that wasn't going to be the substance. But the people running the faith-based office, at least in Bush's first term, were academics. And they were people who had been studying the efficacy of faith and government cooperative efforts for years and years, and actually believed in this stuff and thought that it was good policy. The people with Trump now are drawn almost exclusively from the world of Christian media. And that's something that Ruth Graham and I will get into in much more detail later in the podcast. But they differ quite a bit from the folks who were active around Bush's faith-based office in that while some of them have churches, they're not primarily church-based and heads of organizations or institutions that provide some of these services that might be eligible for federal funding. It's just not what they do. So it's kind of a weird way to appeal to that particular group. But I think that those are some important differences to think about when we're looking at what in fact is this office going to be, and what is it going to do. Bush really benefited from religious advisors and academics around him who had been studying this, and Trump simply doesn't have those people in his circle right now.
Yeah. What's appropriate? I mean, that's like, I keep going back. I'm like, really? Who's the arbiter of that particular, like, who's the decider in that room? That's what I want to know. Yeah. When it comes to Trump and quote unquote religious freedom, we have said this on the podcast before, what he has done with this particular faith-based office and who he has chosen to surround himself with that consider themselves faith leaders raises a sea of red flags. I am swimming in a sea of red flags right now about what this faith office actually is going to do and whether it actually is going to protect the religious freedom for all, right? Or if it's going to be religious freedom for me, but not for thee, which is what we have said here. And, you know, one of the things that, if it is an executive order, if it is an actual government office, there has to be some regulations around, you know, what faiths are represented, all of that kind of stuff. Like, it can't favor one over the other, but again, there's been so many norms broken. There have been so many things that have happened in this administration where, like, the rules just fly out the window and no one cares because, I mean, I don't, who knows why? But I worry that something like this, while it may seem insignificant, while it may fly under the radar for most people who don't pay attention to anything related to faith-based stuff in government, would see it is not a big deal. It's a really big deal. Like, faith-based organizations got millions, if not, I mean, more than that in money from the federal government to do their work in the past. So this it has a lot of strength. It has a lot of might in providing organizations with grants and money and access. And so my question is, if it strips some of those protections that have previously been in place, is it actually going to be a faith office that represents and protects religious freedom for all religious groups? Or is it only going to be in the pocket of some of these conservative evangelicals? And I think this is something that I'm always going to be the advocate. You're always going to be the advocate for people paying attention to faith issues when it comes to politics. But this could actually be a big deal. And this is one of those things where the breaking of norms could really matter. And keeping our eye on it and making sure that it is representative, that it does protect religious freedom for all, is super important. And it's really hard for me to have confidence that it will, especially the way that the guy who just signed the and does not really care about protecting the religious freedoms of people who are different from him or who look different from him. So I think, I don't know, I think this could be really problematic, but maybe that's a cynical take, maybe that's a negative take, but that's kind of how I feel.
Well, and it depends, you know, it's also perfectly possible because these guys appear to know little to nothing
right
about what the other faith-based offices did. It's perfectly possible that it really accomplishes very little, because one of the things that came up during both White House faith initiatives, and by that I mean Bush and Obama, is that there was this assumption, and I would say under the Bush administration, it was an assumption that was encouraged by the political folks, the Karl Roves and others. There was this assumption that it meant the White House was going to have, again, this slush fund that it could just give out to people who supported the president. And I remember a couple of people telling me, you know, that so many phone calls that came into the office were just basically like, where's my money? How do I get my money? And the office did not have money. I mean, it had funds for a few staff members. But what their job was to connect religious and other nonprofits with people out in the federal agencies. And in fact, one of the very first things the Bush White House did was an audit. And I remember they really publicized the start of the audit and said, we're going to go into all these federal agencies and we're going to comb through and we're going to find all the ways in which religious groups are being discriminated against. What they didn't publicize was the result, which was, guess what? They're not being discriminated against. To the extent there was an imbalance in anything that was like an unlevel playing field, what they found was that the preference was given to larger organizations because they simply have better capacity to administer grants. And so, you know, large organizations, both secular and faith-based, were much more likely to have preference for grants than smaller ones. And so they were able to respond. That was actually a very useful finding. And they were able to go through a bunch of the agencies and through their agency-located faith-based offices, find ways to work with smaller nonprofits, both secular and faith-based, to help them get into the funding system. But it's also not, I mean, you have to apply for grants, and there is a rigorous process. And one of the things which I wanted to get back to that Bush always talked about is, you know, we're not just going to give money to people. They have to have proven results. Results, results, results was one of his favorite things to say. Now, this was a little incomplete under Bush. I ended up doing a long reported piece, which sadly is now lost behind some internet paywall forever. But it was in 2004, kind of saying, okay, we've had 3.5 years now to take a look at how this is doing. What have we found? And one of the things was that a lot of these programs did not have built in a mechanism to determine whether the programs were effective or not. So you could talk all you wanted to about how you had to prove that it was producing results. But some of the religious organizations would argue that some of these results are going to be intangible. Like, how do you prove and what metrics are you going to use here? But many of them just simply weren't required to show results. And so that was something that the Obama folks I know had to wrestle with. And Melissa Rogers, who we've interviewed on here before, was the director of the office and Obama's second term and would know so much more than I, the ins and outs of how they tightened things up. But they worked on making sure that the groups that were receiving money actually were effective in providing services and helping people, and also worked to make sure that everybody was protected. You want to make sure, as we've said so many times on this podcast, that people aren't having their religious freedom impacted by having religion forced on them as a requirement for the provision of services. But you also want to make sure that churches that may have outreach efforts don't have the government telling them what to do. And that's one reason why a lot of churches decide not to apply for grants like this, because they want to maintain their independence.
Yeah, I also wonder, talking about those, you know, tightening up of restrictions in previous administrations and how that works. I mean, one of the aspects from what I have understood in the faith office is, you know, if there's, you know, a a breach of religious freedom or anything like that with an organization, they can go to the White House faith-based office. They can file a complaint. They can talk about it with that liaison. And if it's, you know, warranted, it could get, you know, tossed to the Justice Department. I worry about who is going to get preferential treatment.
You think?
Right? I mean, I'm just going to throw that out there that maybe there's some precedent for concern. And I do wonder. I wonder if, let's say, a Muslim organization goes to this White House faith-based office and says, hey, we're experiencing something that is infringing upon our religious freedom. And are they going to get the ear? Are they actually going to be heard? Are their concerns going to be adequately evaluated and potentially passed off to the Justice Department? Which, I mean, then we got to talk about the Justice Department, which is an entirely different thing under Jeff Sessions. But will they even be heard? Will their concerns actually be taken seriously? Or will it just be the conservative evangelical crowd that will get heard, or the anti-LGBT crowd, or the anti-birth control, or whatever the case may be? I really do have some concerns that it won't be equitable.
I think we know the answer.
Right. And that's the thing. Yeah. Like, I think there's substantial precedent to say, like, no, this is a legitimate concern and we all need to be, you know, like, all hands on deck about keeping an eye on it.
But again, when it comes to that, like, they've already seeded a place like HHS.
Right.
With
right.
Their
exactly
people.
Right.
You know, all of the millions of dollars of grants for sex ed are going to abstinence-only programs. Like, this is already happening.
Because that proves to work. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to keep our eyes on. It'll be very interesting to see who gets in there to run the office.
That's what I want to know. Who's going to hold that position?
But, you know, my thought is, if they cared so much about it, why did it take them 16 months to set it up?
Yeah,
right? This is not a key part of his agenda. It was just kind of a, hey, let's throw this at them because we already did a Supreme Court justice. We yelled about the Johnson Amendment. What else we got on our checklist? Not much.
Not much.
I do want to throw out what may be either the best or the worst, depending on how you want to use those words, part of the event last week, which was, if you'll remember, it took place right after Rudy Giuliani had been on TV the night before, basically admitting that indeed Trump did pay hush money to Stormy Daniels.
Best lawyer ever!
Yeah, so as soon as the event ended and the reporters there never have a chance to ask Trump questions, so they're all yelling, why are you changing your story on Stormy Daniels? The conservative evangelicals in attendance started yelling, shame, shame on you. But to be clear, they're not yelling shame at the president.
No.
At the guy who lied about paying a porn star hush money.
No.
She wouldn't talk about the sex that they had while his third wife was recovering from giving birth to their child. They were yelling shame at journalists who are reporting this inconvenient fact. Just tells you everything you need to know about conservative white evangelicals these days. Those are the priorities.
It's going well. Things are going well. We're super happy about the way things are going with conservative white evangelicals.
Yeah.
Speaking of conservative white evangelicals, we should probably move on to our next topic.
Yes, which involves a new marker in the Church Do movement. Last week, Nish, it was reported that Paige Patterson, former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and also, we should make clear, one of the key architects of a conservative takeover of the convention several decades ago. So one of the guys who has made it the lovely institution that it is today, and current president of Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, the denomination's largest seminary. He previously made comments in which he counseled a woman in a physically abusive marriage to simply go home and pray, and definitely not to leave her husband, stay with him. According to his story, this woman showed up at church later with her husband and two black eyes. And Patterson said he was, quote, very happy because her husband came back to church because he felt bad about beating up his wife, which certainly isn't part of, you know, a pattern that we see with abusers, that they are abusive and then feel remorseful and say they'll never do it again and then never do it again? Oh, no.
No.
So other terrible comments surface as well. And people start looking into this. There was a sermon in which Patterson objectified a teenage girl, calling her fine and talking about her well-stacked body, I believe. A teenage girl.
Well-built.
There you go. And he was also reported to have told his female seminary students that the reason they didn't get husbands is because of their looks. Said something like, I can see why people don't give you a second look.
Ugh.
That's lovely. So in response to these reports, women from the Southern Baptist Convention have drafted a letter and a petition calling for Patterson's removal from his current post. And as of the recording of this episode, more than 2,500 women have signed it. Patterson is currently slated to give a sermon at the convention's annual gathering just a few weeks from now. Onish. Now, there are obviously some things to be very, very upset about here. But I gotta say, the, like, rising up as one of all these Southern Baptist women, including women who teach at universities, Liberty University, some women from his own seminary.
Prominent pastors' wives, like very prominent pastors' wives. There's been a lot of people.
There is a bit of a problem in that there is no obvious path that they can follow to demand change.
No.
If you look at the letter and the petition they've written, it is expressing their discomfort, saying this is bad for Christian witness, but there's nothing for them to ask the board of trustees at the seminary to do because women just don't do that. They can't demand that he be removed.
Right.
I mean, they could, but these particular women aren't demanding that.
Right. The theological construction of Southern Baptist, being Southern Baptist, is based on, I mean, so much of it is based on women being submissive to men, right? And that men are leaders, women are submissive. There are specific roles in the church that women cannot fill because they are women. Apparently, having a vagina is a disqualifier, but that's neither here nor there. But here's the thing, because there is, that's kind of the theological underpinning. It's something that in Christianity is called complementarianism. Because that's the theological underpinning of the SBC, when something like this happens, there is none. That's too broad of a brush. I don't know about individual organizations and their, how they operate, but there is very little leeway, wiggle room, space for women to kind of demand change. There's not a lot of space for women to say, this is what needs to happen or else, because women don't hold those positions. They are, like, inherently unable to. So at the highest levels of some of these organizations, it's all men. And so the question now for these women and for the members of the SBC is, will the men of the SBC stand alongside these more than 2,000 women who have signed this petition? Will they stand with those women who say this is completely unacceptable? Not just unacceptable, I think they said it was sinful, which, that's a big statement if you're coming from a Baptist tradition, to say that these actions and his words are sinful. What will these men do? And I think this could be, I don't want to call it a watershed moment. I don't want to call it, you know, an earth-shattering, earth-moving thing, but this could be a step in a really great direction for an organization as conservative as the SBC. If it comes forward and says, you know, we stand with these women. We stand with these women and say that this is not acceptable, that it is sinful, and that we cannot treat women or counsel women in this way. We can't speak about women from the pulpit in this way. I think that that would be a phenomenal statement. Now, whether or not it translates into any sort of change structurally, theologically, that remains to be seen. But I believe in first steps. I believe in baby steps. And if there's just a big question mark right now, what's the SBC going to do? And I'm interested to see what they do. But it could be really important. And I really hope that these women who voice concerns get the answer that they're looking for, get the response that they're looking for. But I am not SBC. I have never been SBC. So I don't want to say I don't have a dog in the fight, because I always stand with women when they say, like, this is unacceptable, and counseling women to stay in abusive marriages is unacceptable. I will stand with those women all the way. I will be ride or die on that train. But I can't help but be really proud of these women, and I can't be prouder to stand alongside them. I did not sign the petition because I don't, you know, affirm as SBC, but I am super proud to stand alongside them and say, like, yeah, this is completely and totally unacceptable. Good on you, ladies, for saying enough. You can't let a guy like this hold that kind of power and to have that kind of placement in an organization that says it values women. And I think they're right. I think they're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, what's frustrating to a lot of people is that it's not just Patterson, obviously.
Right.
And it's not a surprise to anybody, although, you know, the particular quotes that have been highlighted from him are incredibly disturbing. It's not a surprise to anybody that a Southern Baptist pastor would counsel a woman along these lines. If it is just a way to bring more attention to this, and for goodness sakes, it was on the front page of the Washington Post a few days ago, so it's getting attention that it wouldn't have before, then good for them. Karen Swallow Pryor, did I put all of her names in the right? Yes.
Yes.
In the right
yep.
order.
You did.
who teaches at Liberty, she was quoted as saying, you know, this is about more than Patterson. This is about people and systems that have allowed individuals to get away with this behavior for decades. I'm glad that they're focused more widely than just this one dude. It remains to be seen whether opposition from within does anything. I'm not sure that it will, but at the very least, you know, the defensiveness in the past has been, you know, we don't have to listen to people from outside the denomination. Well, do you listen to people within? And I suspect the answer might be no, but at least now they'll know. And we can't move on from this conversation without mentioning the really remarkable open letter that Beth Moore wrote and released last week along these lines. And I won't do it justice, so we will link to that in our show notes. She talks about, you know, just kind of all the indignities she's come up against in her 60 plus years as a Southern Baptist woman. But I do want to read the paragraph where she talks about when this came to a head for her. She says, then early October 2016 surfaced attitudes among some key Christian leaders that smacked of misogyny, objectification, and astonishing disesteem of women, and it spread like wildfire. It was just the beginning, and I came face to face with one of the most demoralizing realizations of my adult life. And that's this. Scripture was not the reason for the colossal disregard and disrespect of women among many of these men. It was only the excuse. Sin was the reason. Ungodliness. That's got to be so hard. I mean, you know, some of us left conservative Baptist circles a long time ago because we don't agree that Scripture says that women have to take lesser positions.
Right.
But to have stayed within and to have fought the fight of just thinking, okay, well, you know, agree to disagree about these scriptural interpretations, and then realize that was all a cover. They just don't like you because you're a woman. They just have no respect for you because you're a woman. And it has nothing to do with religious teaching, or at least religious teaching is only a handy justification for it.
Yeah, that's right. The thing about this story that has been probably, I mean, aside from just the comments itself, and I can't imagine the woman that he counseled to stay in that abusive marriage and then showing up to church with two black eyes. I mean, that's the worst part for me. And the objectification of a young girl. I mean, there, it just gets darker and darker the longer you talk about it. But the other thing that has been remarkably heartbreaking for me to watch as the story has unfolded has been the division that's happening in the SBC over it. That, like, some people, including the current SBC president, he has been remarkably silent about this issue, hasn't really said much, and none of SBC leaders that are men, from what I could see, of a high level of influence, have called him out by name. And the division that's happening in the SBC over something like this is what's most heartbreaking for me, because it seems to me that when it comes to the protection of women in spousal abuse, marital abuse, physical abuse of any kind, the sexualization of young women, particularly from the pulpit, like, this should be something that everyone could get unified behind and say, no, that's unacceptable. That's not okay. It's sinful. We don't talk about women that way. We don't counsel women in that regard. We don't. And the fact that there's division over this is so heartbreaking. Like, it's so sad that some people are looking at this and going, like, I don't see a problem. In fact, Patterson himself has doubled down and said, I have nothing to apologize for. It's like, really, dude? Really? You have nothing to apologize for? You objectified and sexualized a 16-year-old girl from your pulpit. It's horrifying. It's terrible. And the division just goes to show that even though this could be a great step in the right direction, that there is still so much very deeply rooted misogyny, deeply rooted patriarchy within the SBC that may take a long, long, long time to root out structurally and to root out all the way. The fact that it hasn't been universally condemned is in its own right very troubling.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, like, oh, somebody has said it better than this in the past few years, but that the religious right is showing itself to be what its critics always said that it was. And people who've spent years and years and years arguing, no, it's not that they hate women. You just have to see it from their perspective. You know, I think they got to drop it now. this is something we've talked about over and over and over again. But I do think that this, although it is not at all the same as the what the Catholic Church went through with the sex abuse scandals, it is going to have the same effect on the church's witness and in the loss of trust in institutions. And I think we're going to see also a similar huge drop in membership in these churches. They've already been going down. And I think 2016 to now on the subjects of race and misogyny and on supporting this president, and both of those issues are very much tied up in that as well, is going to be for the evangelical church what the sex abuse scandal was for the Catholic Church in America.
Yep, I agree. And I wonder, looking forward, I mean, we saw this petition come out from these SBC women, and anytime some, you know, Trump or anyone in the administration does something terrible or says something horrible about a particular group of people or whatever, we see statements, right? Like we see statements, we see petitions, we see all this stuff coming out, which in and of themselves are good. I think there's something unifying about putting your name to something and like saying, I disagree with this, right? I am going to formally put my name down on paper in public and say, this is wrong. But the question that I have, I think, for women of the SBC who have signed this petition, who have signed this statement looking forward, is going, okay, what if they don't? What if they don't remove him from his post? What if they don't condemn his statements? What if they don't, like, what are you going to do? And this is where some of these statements and petitions, I think, while they're very good and they're a good first step, and for a lot of people, it's the only step that they can take in the moment. But I wonder at what point will people say, enough, I'm done, I'm out. And how much more power could something like this have if a lot of these, you know, women leaders within the SBC said, if you don't do this, then, and then put a consequence on it. Like, we will not attend. We will not contribute. We will not, you know, like this, there has to be a line drawn. There has to be some sort of consequence. Otherwise, people in power are never going to have incentive to change because there isn't consequence. And so that remains to be seen. I'm interested to see how this plays out. I'm hoping, for the sake of these women in this organization and for the sake of women in all faith institutions, that the leaders do the right thing and that they renounce these statements and remove him from his position. But if they don't, yeah. In June. And so we'll see.
Well, we'll know soon enough because the SBC will have its annual meeting in June. So we'll talk about that then. But let's move on to our last topic.
Yep. So for our final topic, let's talk about the link between Trump and his most reliable media outlets. And no, it's not Fox News. It is actually Christian television. To unpack the connection and her brilliant Politico magazine piece on the topic, Amy talked with Ruth Graham, a journalist and regular contributor to both Slate and the New York Times magazine.
So thank you, Ruth, for joining us. I've been wanting to talk with you ever since I read your story in Politico magazine. It kind of blew my mind in that I've been covering religion for 15 years now, and I kind of missed that Christian radio and TV was still as powerful as it is. And every section of your piece, I was just kind of hitting my head against the wall saying, of course, these are the connections between Trump and the people around him and this media industry that has been in place really since the birth of the Christian radio hour in the 1930s. And yet, while I knew that history, I just had not been paying attention at all to its modern incarnation. What got you onto this story in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say it's easy to miss. I was really struck. I'll answer your question, but I was really struck when I first started poking into this, that all of the big academic treatments of Christian TV were in the 80s and, you know, kind of into the early 90s. But after that, it just totally dropped off. So when I was looking around for the academics to talk to about this, who would kind of give me that bigger context, there were multiple times where I reached out to someone and they said, oh, I stopped looking at it in the 90s. I'm totally not up on this anymore. So it just really kind of disappeared, I think, from both academic and, you know, popular consciousness. But it's this whole world of Christian broadcasting, TV and radio, which is a whole other piece of it that I didn't really get into, but is also huge. I have to give credit to my editor, Steve Heuser at Politico, who encouraged me to kind of poke into it. There have been some pieces about the Christian Broadcasting Network in particular, because that's a place where Trump and his surrogates have shown up just astonishingly often. I think, let me look for the number in the piece, but I think he's Trump himself has appeared on CBN like 17 times since the start of his 2016 campaign, and he's appeared, I think, more often.
Yeah, you said that he gave more interviews to CBN in 2017 than to any of the broadcast networks.
Yeah, that's right. So it's just kind of this like pipeline for his message, and he's treated very, very, by friendly interviewers there, I would say. So it's a friendly space for him.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Well, and they pushed back on me a little bit because they said, we're this friendly with everyone. You know, we invite Democrats on, they do appear sometimes, and we're just a friendly space for everyone, which is true to a certain extent.
Yeah, I've been on CBN. It has not been friendly.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's good to know. I'm not surprised. So the CBN piece had sort of been written about, I think not in a terribly deep way.
Right. But you've written about David Brody, who's their chief political correspondent.
Correspondent, exactly. And he wrote this spiritual biography of Trump earlier this year, and he was sort of an early Trump booster. So he's been interviewing Trump since 2011, and they've become close, whatever that means to Trump, but they have a close relationship. But I was also interested in these other networks, which I think get a lot less attention. And I focused on TBN, the Trinity Broadcasting Network, which was founded in the 70s out in California. And it's a much more traditional, like, televangelism outlet. So they broadcast a ton of preaching and just sort of teaching from the word and pastors. But there's a lot of those people have sort of popped up in Trump's inner circle in a really interesting way. So if you look at the advisors around him, the evangelical advisors, an amazing number of them come from Christian TV. So there's Ken and Gloria Copeland. There's actually, don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, Jentison Franklin. Robert Jeffress, who at First Baptist Dallas, his sermons are rebroadcast on TBN. And there's other, who else I'm looking at here at this list, Mark Burns, he founded his own sort of, it's like an online network, but is like modeled on TV. Tony Suarez hosts a show on TBN's Hispanic network. So there's just all these threads running back and forth. And I opened the story, I went to a taping of Mike Huckabee's new-ish show on TBN. So it launched last fall. They kind of poached him. Well, I think Fox let him go. He had a similar kind of talk and variety show on Fox, and TBN picked it up when it was dropped by Fox. And it's really, I mean, he likes to talk about it as just like a friendly, family, folksy variety show, and he plays his bass guitar there sometimes, and there's musical guests. But it's really political. The first interview he did was with Trump, which is, I guess it shouldn't be remarkable that he got that interview because his daughter is the press secretary, but it's still pretty incredible to see a president give a sit-down, two-part interview to TBN, which is not a news-gathering operation. Like, it's just this sort of, it is what it is. It's like it's a site for televangelism. And who else has, Huckabee has recently interviewed Franklin Graham. He's interviewed Netanyahu. The week that I was there to watch, he interviewed Kayleigh McEnany, who's like an RNC spokeswoman and a very outspoken Trump defender. So it's in this sort of folksy variety format, but it's an extremely political show, which is sort of a new thing for TBN. So anyway, that's just a roundabout long-winded way of saying that I just was interested in this kind of symbiotic relationship between the Trump administration and this whole kind of almost underground world of Christian broadcasting that is just, we don't pay a lot of attention to in the mainstream media.
Yeah, it makes so much sense once you read it, but I think a lot of us had looked at the people around Trump and focused mostly on their roots in the prosperity gospel. And thought, well, okay, that connection makes sense because, you know, the focus on your wealth must be a sign of God's blessing, and Donald Trump is wealthy and therefore must be blessed by God. But you really do an excellent job of tracing the media connections of so many of them. And obviously Huckabee is kind of like the ultimate combination of media and political and religious all in one.
yeah, he sort of personifies the whole thing.
Yeah, and yet, yeah. You know, one of the other things that I got to in the piece and was like, of course, was Jay Sekulow, who may be the only one of Trump's lawyers to remain consistent or constant in his orbit, who I knew from religious circles and had kind of thought, well, that's weird that his expertise is not really in the area of defending clients against things like collusion. But you point out that he has a media connection as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. And he has his own radio show and has sort of been in those orbits for quite a while. Yeah, I was struck by that too. It's like a different lens of looking at it. But Robbie Jones at PRRI, or Public Religion Research Institute, said that to me. He said, if you look at the advisory council, it's all these people with media connections. It's not necessarily people with institutional connections in denominations, or, you know, the usual ranks of a pastor's spiritual advisors. It really is people from TV and radio, which is just such a break from the past. It's really kind of incredible. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit? I mean, you told us earlier about the large influence that these outlets seem to have in terms of being able to get Trump on them, and kind of monopolizing the one-on-one appearances that he's making. But talk about the audience that they have as well, because I was kind of astounded to find out how many local stations are connected with some of these networks.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible. It was surprising to me too. So TBN and CBN are different in that CBN is actually no longer, it used to be a traditional network, but now is really just a production company. Mm. So its shows appear on TBN, which is a traditional network and has, it appears in other places too, Daystar and some of these other big groups. The TBN is incredible. So they claim to have access to 100 million households, which is the vast majority of American households. Of course, that does not mean that all those people are watching, but it still means they're in those homes in some way. So they are the third largest television group in the country. They own more local stations than Fox, own more than the three major networks. And they did this in part by gobbling up a lot of small, you know, just sort of local Christian networks who couldn't afford the switch to digital in the 90s. So they expanded hugely just by buying up those stations when they were being forced to go digital. The viewership is a question. They don't make those numbers public. Barna did a survey in 2005 that found that 45% of American adults watch Christian TV over the course of a month. And that's the same rate as in 1992, which is really pretty amazing because 92, that's in the immediate wake of the Gospelgate scandals with Jimmy Swaggart. And, you know, so if you sort of look, it's probably down from the mid 80s, but it's still remained really, really consistent over the last, you know, few decades, which is incredible.
Yeah. And that's also, I mean, 92 would be before the appearance of Fox News in the media landscape. And I think that's a major mistake I made. I don't want to speak for the academics you reached out to, but that I think a lot of folks who knew a little bit about this had made. I just kind of saw Fox News and conservative talk radio, maybe the Rush Limbaughs of the world, as subsuming this Christian media industry. And yet it seems that they have both been able to coexist. I'm wondering if during your reporting you saw any evidence that folks over at Fox, say, were keeping tabs on what's going on in the Christian broadcasting world, because there are some similarities in terms of the religious narratives that they both tend to promote.
Yeah, I wish I had looked into that. I do not have that sense, but it doesn't mean it's not going on, because you're right. There's a significant overlap there. But I mean, I feel like they must be paying attention. But I'm not sure. That's a good question for another piece.
Yeah. So just to kind of wrap up here, in addition to providing a friendlier place for Trump surrogates to come on and to kind of vouch for him by them talking about faith and about what his administration is doing for a specific segment of the religious world that seems to kind of validate his standing as a person of faith with a lot of viewers. What are some of the other storylines that folks are getting who listen to these programs? I think I had seen something about a lot of the coverage of Bible studies in the White House.
That's what I was going to mention. That's a really big one. Along with sort of the usual, like there's just an incredible amount of coverage of Israel. I mean, you just really feel the conservative right's connection to Israel when you watch a lot of this stuff over the course of a few weeks.
And TBN has a Jerusalem studio?
They have a Jerusalem studio. They just started covering or carrying this show, maybe not just, but called The Watchmen, which is like on threats to America's and Israel's security. Hmm. Huckabee was flying to Jerusalem the day after I interviewed him. I mean, it's just this like constant back and forth, constant coverage. So that is something that, you know, sometimes Trump will like pop up with like, oh, we're going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. And, you know, honestly, it's not, I don't follow that stuff that closely. And sometimes I'm like, wait, what is going on? but when you dive into this world, you realize like, okay, this really, really does matter to his base, mm-hmm. or at least this segment of his base. So that's one thing. But yeah, the other thing is this idea that the White House has never been so kind of just saturated with this evangelical presence, which I think is so counterintuitive still to a lot of people who, you know, if you pay attention to who Trump is, but there's all this praying in the Oval Office. There's, you know, again, in these reports on CBN and TBN, some, there's this weekly Bible study involving cabinet members. And that just gets so much coverage. So Mike Pence was on, interviewed by David Brody last week for the National Day of Prayer. And he talked again about just how much prayer there is in the White House. I shouldn't sound sarcastic when I say that. Like, you know, I don't know what's going on in there. But I just would say they seem very, very, it's definitely a theme that they're consciously promoting to these viewers. So.
Yeah. Well, and that, it strikes me that there's a connection with the story of how Trump became familiar with Paula White, who may be his most high profile religious supporter, that also validates him with these voters. And that, you know, the story as they've heard it is he was watching Christian TV, as he does, and ran across her years ago, almost 20 years ago now. And I've heard that and kind of rolled my eyes. But if you hear that enough times, that tells you he's one of you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't know whether to believe that exact story, but I mean, we know Trump likes TV. He likes watching TV.
Absolutely.
Some aesthetic overlap. You know, he grew up, his pastor growing up, Norman Vincent Peale, you know, was a radio guy. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's, you know, do I think he's sort of sitting there down on his knees in prayer, like carefully, you know, following Ken Copeland's exegesis? No. But I think it's possible that he's watched, you know, quite a bit of this stuff over the years. He certainly had an intuitive sense early on that it made sense to reach out to these people. So again, you know, forging this relationship with David Brody back in 2011, that's where he sort of first explained his conversion to becoming pro-life. You know, that was a CBN interview. So he has had a sense, you know, way earlier than a lot of us did, that this would be an important outlet for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you wrote about it. I'm glad you at least alerted me to the continued importance of Christian broadcasting, and sounds like I'm going to have to turn on TBN every so often and just at least keep tabs of what's going on. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy.
To wrap up the show, we have a new segment called praise and petitions, in which we shout out the things that are bringing us joy and call out the people and situations who are making us cranky. I will start us off. Nish, I'm going to call out pollen. Pollen has it in for me.
Yeah.
We get exactly 2 days in between too cold to be outside and me sneezing my head off and having just sinuses full.
I'm so sorry.
So I'm excited to have spring here. I'm excited that it's warm enough that I can be outside and be at the lake. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to have a beach picnic on Sunday for Mother's Day and my birthday. But I got to call you out, pollen. Not cool.
No way.
Not cool at all.
It is the worst. I got a call from Rowan's school today and the lady was like, did Rowan wake up with like goopy eyes at all? Because he's been itching his eyes all morning. And I'm like, no, because they're thinking it's pink eye. But we've all been a little bit sneezy, a little bit, you know, runny nose, a little stuffy and itchy. And the sweet lady at the school was like, I think it's probably just allergies. I think we're all a little sneezy. I'm like, I would bet that's it. So I'm with you. Pollen sucks. Super dumb.
But on the bright side, I have to praise a couple things in our newly adopted city of Chicago/Evanston. Over the weekend, I went with our little four-year-old to a family concert that the Chicago Symphony Orchestra puts on. They have a series over the course of the year. And it is the most fun. It's in the full concert hall, and it is the full symphony orchestra. And they put on a few different selections by Russian composers. And as you know, Nish, he is quite the dancer.
He is quite the dancer.
And into music. And they did selections from Swan Lake, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, and Stravinsky's The Firebird. And he was so excited. He's already always excited to see the instruments because we sit right up behind where the instruments are. But there were also dancers from the Joffrey Ballet performing for Swan Lake and Firebird. And it was just the sweetest. It's all wrapped up in an hour. It's perfect for a little four-year-old.
Perfect.
Just makes me so happy. And on our way back from that, we picked up Noam and the seven-year-old, my daughter, at a kite festival, which they call Chicago the Windy City. Might as well make the best of it. Every spring, there's this kite festival right off the lake. And it was just a gorgeous day for it.
Oh.
Just brilliant, colorful sky. And
so
it was the
cool.
best. So I'm enjoying a spring in Chicago.
That's amazing.
What about you this week?
You know what? Can I just ask in advance for a request from you?
Yes.
That Cormac and his love of music and dancing, please promise me and our listeners here that if you ever take him to an Amy Grant concert, that you will record it for all of us to delight in, because I'm afraid that, well, actually I'm a little afraid if you take him to an Amy Grant concert that it just might make his brain like melt out of his ears. He's not going to know what to do with himself.
Can I tell you, I'm working on this. Amy Grant's manager commented on my Twitter
what
feed because of my little, like, this is why I did it. I placed her in my last New York Times column. And so somebody was like, hey, did you see this? And tagged her manager. And so just, you know, doing a little strategizing about how to work that into an introduction for Cormac.
Oh, you're playing the long game. You are playing the long game. I like your style. So, okay, if this plays out, I want like a full recording and a full recounting of the experience, please. Okay. Let's see. Okay, praise. What is something that I love? The John Mulaney stand-up special.
Oh, my word. Did
Netflix.
I not tell you?
Well, I knew it was coming out.
We saw
I knew
him.
That it was happening. I just hadn't watched it yet. Oh, you went and saw him. That's right. You went and saw
it. Oh, my goodness. And I now have rewatched the bit about the school assemblies like 10 times. It makes me just cry. Detective JJ Bittenbinder.
It's so good. Oh my gosh. Okay. And how he describes President Trump as the horse in a hospital. I have never. Oh my! It was like the perfect explanation of the situation that we're in. If you haven't watched John Mulaney's stand-up special on Netflix, it is so good. It is so funny. His comedic delivery. He's very old school. Like, he feels very old school in his delivery.
That's what I love about it.
Yes, you know, it's very old school stand-up comedy, except for like the F-bombs and everything else.
I was thinking about this recently. He's got some F-bombs, but yes. Like, you know, people have been having debates, obviously, and the Bill Cosby verdict raised this again of, you know, yes, we want to punish these men, but, you know, oh, isn't it a shame that we're going to lose the rest of their work? You know what? I don't miss Louis C.K. I have laughed at some of his comedy, but I will take a John Mahaney, and good Lord, please don't let anything come about John Mahaney.
Is it Mahaney or Mulaney? I can never remember.
Mulaney.
You're right. Yeah, sorry.
Whatever. I'm so Yogi Berra when it comes to words.
No worries.
Names. Anyway, but I'm comfortable with his comedy. It's hilarious. Right. It could be very biting.
Yep.
But it doesn't make me feel gross the same way that so much of Louis C.K. and other comics do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I am not a language lightweight. I'm fine watching something with a lot of language. It doesn't bother me. But just FYI to listeners, if you're on the Jim Gaffigan train or something, like, you're not going to watch something with swearing in it, then John Mulaney may not be for you. But he's very old school in his delivery, and it is super, super, super funny. So please make sure you watch it. That is my praise. You know what? I'm trying to think if I have anything that I'm like super angry about, aside from I still don't have regular internet at my house. You know, there's a lot to love about small town life. I've adjusted to it quite well. It's amazing. I love seeing the same people every day and not driving more than 4 minutes anywhere in town. It's incredible. But can a girl get some internet? That is all I'm asking, is can I please get some internet at my house? But the snow has melted.
Lord, hear our prayer.
And next week, they're drilling under the street. That's the word. So hopefully I'll be able to like access the real world on a regular basis. So that is my petition. Make it happen. Okay. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!